the complaints, why would not Biden move to put people in there to replace DeJoy? But maybe someday when Biden's on Law and Disorder, you can ask him.
Thank you, Chuck, for that. So let's talk about moving forward and what's happening and maybe what some of our listeners can do. What measures did the states put in place to counteract the potential delays in mail-in voting, such as drop boxes, et cetera? And were they enough of a safeguard for the vote coming up this November?
I think so. Of course, you know, there's always ways that people can, you know, if they don't want to mail in their ballot, they should have in certain places either voting centers or secure drop boxes where people can drop off ballots. But really, at this point, you know, people just have to, you know, monitor their mail, see, you know, even the election mail, the mail that goes out during elections that, you know, candidates, you know, advertise themselves and mail things to your home, whatever. Be aware of that. Look at that and see if you're getting that election mail in time, because it doesn't do either candidates or the voting public any good if they receive the advertisements for the election candidates after the election has taken place. So monitor your own mail. Make sure it's happening in time. And if it's, and if you feel that it's not, you know, go directly to your local post office, complain to them and tell them, listen, I'm not getting this mail on time. I want to know what's being done about it and why it's happened. But maybe I'm being naive, but I'm actually somewhat confident that because of all the pressure, there'll be adequate staffing and hours open and all of that stuff to make sure that this, you know, mail goes through prior to the election, during the election, and following the election, getting the, you know, the ballots counted. So again, people at home, you know, you see what's going on. Don't hesitate to, if you feel it necessary, to go to contact your local post office or call up your member of Congress, senator, House member, and file a complaint. But also, I think at this point, as I said, I might be naive, I actually think that this is going to be a pretty good election season because of you know, the pressure like this program has done and other people have done and what the members of Congress have done and civic organizations have put the pressure on the Postal Service, that I think, you know, DeJoy has to make sure, because all they have to do is make sure that there's adequate staffing and the postal workers will make sure that the mail gets through and the ballots will be delivered on time.
Well, in that vein, Chuck, what's the role of the Postal Regulatory Commission, which oversees the post office operations? What's their job, and can they intervene if DeJoy's policies are found to undermine election integrity?
Actually, DeJoy has gone out after the Postal Regulatory Commission and feels like it's unnecessary and that they should be eliminated. So I don't know how much good feeling there is to DeJoy, but again, yes, he has to be responsible, and they have the power to deal with them. But again, it's the Board of Governors who are the ones who can, you know, hire and fire. So again, Postal Regulatory Commission is somebody, another agency that people can go to and to file complaints if necessary. But there's a lot of power that the Postmaster General has. There's an activist postal board of governors. That's really the ones who are there. But the, you know, Postal Regulatory Commission is there to make sure that, you know, he follows the laws and make sure that he's doing what he's supposed to do.
So how are grassroots organizations and voting rights advocates preparing for any potential disruptions in the 2024 election? Can individual voters do anything to ensure that their ballots are counted?
Making sure that you receive your ballot on time is important, and to act upon that. And even though there's time, the sooner you get in your ballot, the better it is. And in terms of, you know, the counting of the ballots, that's once the Postal Service delivers the ballots, I guess it's the local election committees are the ones who actually count the ballots. But making sure you get your ballot on time, getting it as quickly as possible, and making sure that your elected officials understand from you that it's important. Because again, without hearing from the public, they don't know how important it is as an issue to the public. So, you know, contacting your elected officials and let them know that you're concerned that you mailed in your ballot, you want to make sure that it's received on time and counted, can only be helpful.
You know, Chuck, it's been so important to have you on the program. Law and Disorder has been examining American institutions that have been undermined during the Trump administration, and now with Project 2025, the kinds of threats that the conservative movement is making to a whole range of institutions in American life. And sometimes we don't think enough about those institutions, including the Postal Service. Today, you've really illuminated how important it is, and frankly, throughout the year, between elections, to getting our information, to be able to communicate with each other, despite the use of social media and internet and email and all the rest. It's been very elucidating for me, and I think our listeners. How can folks stay abreast of these issues regarding your union, DeJoy, and the Postal Service?
Well, you can go to apwu.org. That's the National Union's website. You can also go to New York Metro Area Postal Union a website. And then just to stay abreast of what's happening as you get the news reported to you, if there's anything that involves having to do with election ballots or whatever, you know, make sure that they're speaking to the Postal Service too. And if they need any help in any area, they can contact the unions. My union, apwu.org, is a place to go, because we are feel that, you know, we're committed to the public, and we're there to make sure that the public is represented as they need to be, and also their mail is received and delivered on time.
Chuck, we're grateful to you today, but we're really grateful to you every day that you wake up, that you're doing this work as the legislative director of your union. It's very important, and maybe people and even elected officials will have a better understanding of the role that unions play in our deliberative process as a source of advocacy, as a source of oversight. The degree to which unions have been trashed in recent years, you are an example of the importance of unions and the role they play in our democracy.
Well, thank you for that. And to a lot of American people, during COVID, the only representative of the government they saw during that time was the person who worked for the post office.
Chuck, we're grateful again to have you on Law and Disorder. Be well and be safe.
Thank you. And anytime you want me back in the future, just let me know. Thank you.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org. Operating in the secrecy of the nation's more than 1,800 prisons, for decades, a kind of shadow slave culture has been fostered. Few Americans are aware of the exploitative and pervasive practice of forced prison labor. The 13th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution abolished slavery, but it made one exception: prison labor. Prisoners are forced to work with minimal or non-existent wages, and often with no labor protections. Understanding the scope and implications of forced prison labor is crucial for anyone concerned with social justice and equality. It calls for a re-examination of our treatment of incarcerated persons and for alternatives that promote fairness for everyone, regardless of their legal status. By shining a light on this issue, we can advocate for reforms that prioritize rehabilitation over punishment and strive toward a more just and humane criminal justice system. A new book, Abolition Labor, The Fight to End Prison Slavery, provides an eye-opening overview of the extent of this problem. Today, we're honored to talk with two of its three authors. Up first is Andrew Ross, a renowned social activist, author, and professor of social and cultural analysis at New York University, where he also directs the Prison Research Lab. Andrew has contributed to prominent publications like The Guardian, The New York Times, and The Nation. He has authored or edited over 25 books, with the recent work of Abolition Labor co-authored with Ayuba Thomas and Tommaso Bardelli. Andrew, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thanks for having me back on.
Tell us how you first became interested in the issue of prison labor.
Well, one of my jobs is to direct the Prison Research Lab at New York University, and we and our formerly incarcerated students there, you know, do interviews with their peers, formerly incarcerated people. Prison labor is, I mean, it's impossible to avoid in the interviews that we do, but we decided to do this larger project and the book that came out of it, largely because prison labor is not well understood in the public mind. You know, when the topic comes up, most people think of license plates or they think of Victoria's Secret or other corporations using prison labor. But in fact, the percentage of private contract labor for corporations is very small in this country. There are other misconceptions that I can talk about, but in general, we wanted to provide a more holistic picture of what it's like to labor behind the walls.
In a nutshell, please describe how prison labor works for people who don't know much about it.
Well, the first thing to be said is that it's a form of forced labor. A lot of our book is about the fight to end slavery, prison slavery, because forced labor is constitutionally authorized under the 13th Amendment. There's an exception clause in there that allows indentured servitude to exist for those who are convicted of a crime. And so we're talking about labor that's not free labor. And incarcerated men and women have no choice. And the jobs that they do pretty much cover the entire spectrum. Everything that people do in the free world for a livelihood or a job, it also happens behind the walls. Everything from, you know, basic cleaning of cells to skilled manufacturing and skilled service provision.
Speaking of the 13th Amendment's prison slavery exception, can you briefly discuss efforts to abolish it, and what other changes do you think need to be made to resolve this corrupt state?
Well, most Americans, it turns out, according to surveys, are unaware of the loophole in the 13th Amendment that authorizes forced labor behind bars. And a large part of our book is an effort to chronicle the movement to end the exception in the 13th Amendment. That is a national movement that has been proceeding in state after state, passing state constitutional amendments. Most recently, the California legislature actually just last week passed a bill to send an amendment to the ballot in November. Voters will have a chance to vote on, and that was a big win. And there are seven other states that have passed those so far, and there's also a federal constitutional amendment campaign underway. So this is part of a movement. We're part of it in New York State. We're part of the coalition here trying to pass legislation in New York State. For the most part, it's an anti-slavery campaign, but there are also other consequences. Once you've abolished forced labor, then what do you do about the wages question? And this is a big issue within the movement. Do you push for legislation that will raise wages? Should it be a minimum wage? Should it be less than a minimum wage? Should other elements of the standard labor package, like the right to organize and workplace protection, should they be part of the package? These are all things that we discuss in the book, and we have our own positions, but we try to give an airing to others. So that's a large part of the book.
How does prison labor affect the broader economy and the economic lives of millions of American households?
That's a very good question, because during the era of mass incarceration, when we had more than 2 million American men and women locked up behind bars, basically we were withdrawing 2 million workers from the labor force. I mean, many of these people would not have been employed. And one of the favorite theories of mass incarceration at the time was that this was a form of warehousing surplus members of the working class who had been disemployed by deindustrialization. And they were just put behind bars where they were put to work running the prisons, basically. There's been a decline in incarcerated population since then. We're currently at about 1.2 million. We found in our interviews that there's a lot of continuity between what happens behind the walls and what happens in the free world economy. For example, most people in a low-wage economy, which is basically for most Americans what we live in, they need to have something on the side to supplement their income, right? This is the case also in prison. Because of the ultra-low wages, which, you know, average, let's say, in New York State, about 15 cents an hour. In some states, you're not paid at all. In order to survive, you have to have a hustle on the side. So there's a very vibrant informal economy, and we spend a lot of time in the book gathering testimony about it. So the more accurate picture of labor behind the walls is a lousy wage and a hustle. You have to have something to supplement the ultra-low pay that is available. And we find that that's not all that different from, as I said, the free world economy. And it's one of the reasons why so many people end up in prison, because they have to resort to illegal activities to get by. And why so many are reincarcerated, because they're not given a chance of adequate employment on reentry. So they revert to illegal activities and end up back inside.
This is Michael Smith. I'm with my co-host, Heidi Boghossian. We're speaking with Professor Andrew Ross, who's just had published the book Abolition Labor. Andrew, why is there such strong resistance to ending forced labor within the prison system?
There's a lot of resistance to it for a number of reasons. One of them is that if you give prisoners the right to refuse labor, then you take away a major component of discipline in the prison. You're taking away from prison guards a way of coercing and disciplining the population. Because if you refuse to work, then the consequences can be quite dire. You can end up in solitary confinement. You can have your privileges, all sorts of privileges cut off, and so on and so forth. So it alters the balance of power inside the prison if you give incarcerated people the right to refuse certain kinds of work, either because they're ill-paid or they're unsafe or whatever. That's something we found, because the threat of violence is omnipresent. We found that that balance of power is very important to maintain. The other reason is that if you withdraw forced labor, then, as I said earlier, there are these consequences that follow on, which lead to lawmakers asking themselves, well, how much will it cost the state if we have to raise wages? Forced labor is no longer legal, and their demands for higher wages, how much will it cost us?
Andrew, throughout the research and writing process with your two co-authors, what was your most surprising or impactful finding?
The most surprising I think the most, well, first of all, we did interviews in four states, New York, Alabama, Georgia, and Texas. The three others, Texas and Georgia and Alabama, are places where people are not paid at all for their labor. I think Alabama was the most surprising. We spent quite a bit of time doing field trips to Alabama, and we were prepared for essentially a different kind of prison system. And given the history of Alabama, this resistance to, you know, racial reforms and convict leasing in Alabama was worse than in any other southern state during its heyday, lasted longer and was more brutal. So we were expecting something quite different from what we were used to in New York. But I don't think we expected to find such a completely lawless environment in the Alabama penitentiary system. There are very few guards, correctional officers who are willing to take on that job, which is quite dangerous, only do it because they can earn a lot of money smuggling in contraband, drugs or guns or cell phones. And many of them are connected to organized crime on the outside. But there are basically not enough of them, really, to protect the incarcerated population. So it's a very lawless environment. There's a lot of violence. There's very little prospect of parole. You have more chance of coming out in a body bag than coming out on parole. The number of deaths every year is sort of skyrocketing. It's really difficult to summarize how awful it is, really. That was our biggest surprise, I think, even though we were expecting the worst in Alabama.
Andrew Ross, you've co-written the book Abolition Labor, and I wanted to ask you, what can the general public do to help end prison labor and address broader criminal justice reform issues?
One thing to do is educate yourself. Public education is very important. As I mentioned earlier on, there are a lot of misconceptions about prison labor. And another one I could mention is the extent of privatized prisons. In the public mind, a lot of prisons are under private operation, when in fact, probably less than 6% of the beds nationally are in private hands, and they're mostly concentrated in southern states. The vast majority of prison labor is done at the behest of public authorities, government agencies. Most of the manufactured goods and services are purchased by government agencies, and corporations play a limited role in all of this. So we think it's important that the public, members of the public who are interested, learn about this. One of the reasons we wrote the book, if you want to get involved in the campaigns, it's easy to do. Most states have a coalition that is trying to pass legislation. The one that we're involved in New York is called 13th Forward. It's a very broad coalition. There's a couple of bills that we push every year in the legislature. One is the Abolish Slavery Constitutional Amendment Bill. And the other one, and this is, we're the only state where this is currently the case. The other one is a wages bill called the Fairness and Opportunity for Incarcerated Workers. And that's a bill that would provide a minimum wage, right to organize, workplace protections, and also set up a statewide monitoring board for overseeing the implementation of those measures.
Andrew, how can our listeners follow your work?
We're part of NYU's Prison Education Program. We're the research arm of the Prison Education Program. That's the best place to follow what we do, and also our other publications, which include our last book, Cars and Jails, which we were also talking about on this show some time ago, a couple of years ago, I think. And so we're pretty active in pushing out our research into the public realm.
I wanted to mention, Andrew, that Orr Books published Cars and Jails and also published Abolition Labor. Orr Books, I think you can get it at orrbooks.com.
Thank you for your important work and for bringing these problems to the public fore. We're going to go speak with one of your co-authors, and we wish you the best with this wonderful book.
Thank you. Thank you. It's been a great pleasure to talk to you both.
Following Andrew, we're delighted to introduce another co-author of Abolition Labor, Ayuba Thomas. Ayuba recently earned his MA from NYU's Gallatin School of Individualized Study and is an affiliate of the NYU Prison Research Lab. He currently serves as project manager for the Movements Against Mass Incarceration's Archival Oral History Project at Columbia University. There, he documents the experiences and challenges faced by those affected by the criminal justice system. His first-hand perspective and his extensive knowledge on the subject makes him a powerful voice in the conversation of abolishing forced prison labor. Ayuba, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you for having me.
How has your personal experience influenced your work on this book and also in the abolitionist movement?
As a person with lived experience, I actually had to go through a lot of the things that these other people we interviewed for this book went through. I didn't really see it to the same point of being such a big problem. It was just a personal thing of, I don't want to work here. I'm not getting paid. You know, this is terrible. I didn't really see the whole picture. But doing the research actually let me hone in and see the issues that are pervasively just attacking our system and attacking our communities.
Ayuba Thomas, you've worked as project manager for the Movement Against Mass Incarceration Project at Columbia University's Insight. How did that work influence the themes in Abolition Labor, the book that you co-authored?
Ironically enough, two of the organizations that I work with in the movement to against mass incarceration are actually people I met through doing this research. So I work with an organization called Both Sides of the Wall. They were very integral in doing prison strikes on the inside as well as doing supportive protests on the outside, you know, going to the government stairs and approaching all of the lawyers and the politicians to try to get this change to the system of Alabama's prison system, which is terrible. And then also Georgia, there's Bard Business, who is a nonprofit company that helps people in Georgia work, get work, and they have a lot of political movements, and they've been working on legislation to actually get the people who are formerly incarcerated a protected class. So, you know, the work that I did with the incarceration, with the abolition labor, it actually influenced more of my work that I do right now currently.
Ayuba, what are the initial steps needed to fix this broken system of prison labor?
Well, there's a lot of steps, but it would help first by eradicating that clause in the 13th Amendment that allows people to be used as slave labor in the prison system. Something that happens frequently is that, you know, people get taken off of the streets and put into prison, removed from communities, removed from their families, and the work that they do, they don't get paid for. So what happens is the family has to then pull together and take more resources away from the community and make sure that person is sustained and has a healthy diet and is able to come home safely. So one of the biggest things right now is to be politicians and, you know, the community to forge together and try to get that exemption clause removed.
How do forced labor practices affect the families and communities of incarcerated individuals?
Prison is a dually extractive process, right? So a person who once was a provider or some kind of stationary placeholder in a family, whether it be financially, spiritually, or just a physical presence, that's removed. And then the community who's already missing a piece, who's already missing an addition, has to then take out of their losses that they have and contribute back into the prison system by sending their families money. The phone systems cost money. Clothing costs money. Food costs money. So the nature of prison is just to keep taking from the community. And it's a terrible thing.
Ayuba, what are the systemic and also cultural issues in America's penal system that perpetuate this forced labor and exploitation of incarcerated persons?
The system, you know, in itself is made to perpetuate and keep going and keep helping itself live. So as people are taken away from the communities, it's particular people that are taken away from the communities. A lot of people will contest that, you know, largely it's white people that are incarcerated, but it's only because of the disparity in how many people exist here. You know, the population of black Americans that get locked up opposed to the populations of white Americans that get locked up, you know, statistically, it's pretty much like 5-1, 7-1 in a black community where it's 1-1. So that kind of says a lot. And when you think about the arrested development of the communities that these people are extracted from, they're already in marginalized and disenfranchised situations. So the system just keeps perpetuating itself and it keeps people lingering in the same system, in the same locations, in the same ghettos. And as with the labor situation, if people don't have enough to sustain inside, they probably are going to go to doing illegal practices again. And then on top of that, when they're released, if they don't have enough to sustain outside, they're going to go to illegal practices again. So that's why we have such a large rate of recidivism. If people were to get paid, we're not asking for a whole lot of money, you know, just a little bit more, something when they're in prison they can sustain, and then when they come home that they're able to, you know, have a footing and have some kind of foundation so they don't get caught back up in the system.
We're speaking with Ayuba Thomas, a former incarcerated person. I wanted to ask you, Ayuba, how does the issue of prison labor intersect with other social justice issues such as racist inequality, economic disparity, human rights?
I mean, it's a simple thing that when you lock people up and you take people away, they can't contribute no more. It happens in specific locales. It happens to specific communities, to specific populations. So it is racial inequality all through. I always say that we remember that a lot of this took place with the emancipation era, you know, when people were freed and then became Jim Crow era, because the free people were being subjected to unfair laws, unfair behavior by the police officials, by the government officials, and we were extracted and taken off of the streets because we were, at the time, they called it vagrancy. So they have a bunch of different laws in different communities that are only there in those communities, and it doesn't exist outside of the place. Like, for example, I'll use bike riding, for example. There's been, in the early 70s and the early 80s, they made, in certain communities, riding a bike on the street illegal. So that was a way for people to get drawn into the system. You know, you make these petty laws, you make these petty rules that people can't really abide by because it's not fair. If I don't have a job, where do you want me to be? It's unfair, and it's not, you know, directed at a general population. It's directed at specific populations.
Ayuba Thomas, thank you so much for being on Law & Disorder. Before we have to let you go, can you tell us how listeners can follow your work?
You know, I'm terrible at social media, but I do have a page at Insight. That's where I work with the movements for mass incarceration. We post up things there regularly. I'm also part of the NYU PP Research Lab, so you can look that up. But right now, you just Google my name. You know, I've done some work, and I'm going to continue to do work. Hopefully, you know, you can get to it and see it.
That's A-I-Y-U-B-A, Ayuba Thomas. Thank you so much, Ayuba. It's been really great having you on Law & Disorder. You take it easy.
Thank you for having me, and I really appreciate it. And, you know, you guys are doing great work, and continue the great work.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org. One word, lawanddisorder.org.
A quick reminder, if you want to listen to Law & Disorder's podcast, one way to do that is visit lawanddisorder.org. There you'll see our podcast players now positioned at the bottom of each show's post. And there you can click on the three dots in the right corner of the player to either, well, download, subscribe, or visit the podcast page. Good, 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 good. That's great.
Arrow, that's when the talking starts in the language. Michael Norman, your health tip of the day from the African American Wellness Project. Infections like polio, smallpox, and measles used to be as common as coronaviruses today. But now we have life-saving vaccines for those and other diseases. Sadly, too many children still go unvaccinated. Choosing to delay or refuse vaccine puts your child and other children at serious risk. So talk to your child's doctor today about vaccines. And for more information, visit aawellnessproject.org.
This is Brad Keselowski, driver number 2, Discount Tire Ford Mustang. Racing fans know that a quick pit stop to check the tires can give me the winning edge. The same is true for your car. Proper tire tread helps keep traction on the road and everyday driving. To check your tread, simply insert a penny, Lincoln's head first, into your tire grooves. If you can see all of Honest Abe's head, it's time to get your tires checked by a professional.
A message from the U.S. Tire Manufacturers Association.
Today, 1 in 5 Americans experience emotional and mental health challenges, but many of us don't know how to ask for help.
At the American Psychiatric Association Foundation, we work every day to eliminate stigma and advance mental health. Visit mentallyhealthynation.org to learn more.
WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM. My name's Anthony Cacciato, and you're listening to The Angry Young Man. Well, good morning, everybody. Happy Tuesday if you're listening on Tuesday, and happy Thursday in the future if you're listening on Thursday, or I think it's Friday, actually, now. Weird schedule shifting. Happy good morning. But also happy Constitution Day. Constitution Day is today. What a wonderful way to kind of frame what we're going to be addressing kind of sort of today. Just before we get into the mix of things, as always, everything you hear on the show today is strictly my view and not representative of the station's view on the whole. If I have anyone else soon enough, 9:30 doesn't seem to be very conducive to college students looking to hop on for a nice little conversation. I don't blame them. I haven't even had my coffee yet, but that's a little bit more my fault than anything. But today, is Constitution Day. So what I wanted to do was touch on a couple quick little news tidbits worth noting. And then going on to talk a little bit about, the Constitution. Why do we even want to talk about the Constitution? Is, the Constitution worth talking about? Is the Constitution worth keeping? All this and more on The Angry Young Man today. So, we'll start off just with, for those of you who have been following the show for a while, you'll know I'm, bit of a Milei fanatic, Javier Milei from Argentina, the current president of the country, for running up on about a year in December. What's going on down there? Well, things are turning. The wheels of government are turning, and he's just been doing what politicians tend not to do, and following through on promises and making the hard choices very often. So a quick recap for those of you who are unaware with the situation in Argentina. Argentina has long been in a state of stagnation ever since Juan Perón took power in the 1950s and instituted his kind of third way economic, whatever you want to call it, that involved mass nationalization of different firms in the country, specifically British investment. Basically, it was kind of like a, we're not socialists, but we're not, we're not going to turn away from some of those wonderful goodies that they've been using out there. So what happens? Argentina goes from being like a top-rate world economy, like preeminent power in like the secondary or tertiary league of powers. Like they were on par with Australia, which isn't, like, wow, they're on par with Australia. But I mean, it was pretty good. They were doing great and they were set to grow. But Perón kind of killed that. And they've stagnated since. I've dealt with massive inflation recently as well due to fiscally irresponsible management of government. Between massive spending, price controls, and nationalization of key industries, as well as massive import barriers, the country kind of turned itself upside down, inside out, and kind of screwed everyone over. I mean, I'll be frank. I had my grandmother was born in Argentina, left Argentina in the 1950s with my great-grandparents because of the regime change in Argentina when Perón became president and started instituting these reforms. It spelled trouble for everybody. Everyone was trying to get out if they had the ability to do so. But anyways, what happens in the kind of midst of this crisis arrives this guy, Javier Milei. Now, who is he? This guy was an economist who'd go on talk shows and kind of talk about, you know, why is government and what it's doing right now completely and utterly irresponsible and ineffective and ultimately being the reason that you're going through so much hardship. I mean, he had a very energetic style that kind of caught about him. But what he was doing that a lot of people weren't doing is talking about the economic ideas of Austrian school economists. Now, the Austrian school, started by a guy named, I'm blanking right now, it's early in the morning, blanking on the founder right now, but Karl Menger, there we go, kind of developed and made popular by Ludwig von Mises, who was an Austrian economist who then mentored many other economists, namely Friedrich Hayek in that mix as well. But why are they important? They offer this perception of economics that kind of centers itself on certain principles, which can be best described as free market in nature. And while, you know, in many cases their ideas have kind of been taken on by either the mainstream or Chicago economists, I mean, Milton Friedman took a lot of cues from Austrian economics, but Milei, as an economist, was, you know, kind of the way that he went about describing himself was as an Austrian, and in terms of his influences. All this to say, though, he brought this radical idea of cutting down the government, you know, reducing the state, reducing expenditure, and putting the kind of passing the buck back to the people of Argentina. And in the midst of triple-digit inflation, and in an election where he was running against the economic minister of that administration, which had caused the inflation, Milei managed to pull out first and became the first libertarian president in world history. Now, what has he been doing? Dramatically cutting down government bureaucracy, tapering back spending, massive austerity, which, you know, one of the things he acknowledged at the outset was the difficulty of, you know, trying to do this without any pain. There was going to be pain eventually in repealing years and years of failed policy in Argentina. And, you know, while there's been some pain, there's been tremendous gain. Inflation almost slowed down to a halt, as well as massive surplus compared to what had been seen in the past. Now, all this to say, tying back to the present, he recently got up in front of their Congress and basically made a declaration of, you know, we're going to cut the deficit with this spending bill, or I'm not going to pass it. I'm going to veto it. Taking a very strong stand on that matter, I mean, I can maybe even get a quote here in terms of what he said on the budget, but the, you know, he's not compromising here. I mean, so he basically went up and said, well, you know, I promised a financial surplus, fiscal surplus. If you attempt to threaten this zero deficit plan, I'm going to knock it down. Which, listen, I think that that takes a lot of sheer confidence and, you know, bravery to be able to stand up there and make those sorts of tough decisions in the interest of fixing your country. Now, how does this all tie back to the kind of grander theme of today? So I actually wrote something not too long ago, put it out on out of my local paper back in New York. But Milei and what he stands for and what he's trying to achieve stands at the very heart of the ideas that founded our nation. Now, what do I mean by that? The United States exists, you know, very, very differently than other countries as a country built on ideas. A country built on the idea that you should have determination over your life, what you do, how you spend your money. You know, these are very core tenets of what America is supposed to be. It's enshrined and woven through our Constitution. Our Constitution is inherently a document which aims to uphold the idea that there ought to be government which is limited, government which works for the people, and government which cannot overly intrude itself on the lives of its citizens. You know, we had a Bill of Rights as well, which, you know, there's the argument to be made that it was redundant because, of course, people wouldn't look at the Constitution and, you know, assume that those, you know, those rights are not a given. They said, you know, how could we expect that, you know, if the Constitution already goes about ensuring that government can't trample on these rights intrinsically, why should we have to spell it out? As we've seen in the last 200 or so years, we really needed to spell it out. It's kind of scary how much we needed to spell it out for numerous reasons. You know, for one, the amount of times that, I mean, you could look back to American legal history and jurisprudence that surrounded Bill of Rights related cases. I mean, it's the amount of times we'd have to lean back on those provisions of the Constitution to ensure that government is not having a field day trampling your rights is tremendous. I mean, to this day, I mean, we have consistent attacks from government on Bill of Rights, you know, enumerated rights, you know. Well, to, you know, kind of even go back for a second, I mean, we, you know, a lot of these people that founded our government said, why should we even have to spell it out? You know, people should be already able to know that looking at this document, the government's granted very specific things that it can do. And among those things that it can't do is restrict your right to free speech, your right to bear arms, your right to, you know, any number of things listed in the Bill of Rights. But there was a push to kind of enumerate them because with very valid concern, the government could very quickly trample those rights. You know, government, even with the Bill of Rights in place, has gone and kind of made a mockery of our Constitution in many ways. It's a very good book I read not too long ago called Who Killed the Constitution? It's a Tom Woods book, and it kind of goes through this long, not really long, but through many case studies in which the federal government has outright just ignored the Constitution. The purpose of why we have the Constitution is to very explicitly limit the scope of government. But what we've seen over the past 200 or so years is that government will find every little nook and cranny in which it can expand its power and do so, you know. The executive will take opportunities to ban speech which is detrimental to the war effort with the Sedition Acts, or it will intern Japanese Americans or Italian Americans or German Americans because they're seen as a national security threat. It will intervene in labor negotiations and, you know, any number of things that constitutionally are completely, totally unthinkable. But just do it anyways, because who's going to stop them? You know, it all kind of ties back to, you know, why the ideas that we have that are central to who we are. In large part, you know, while we have a constitution that is embedded with those ideas of liberty, limited government, self-determination, we very often fail to follow through on those ideas and fail to ensure that the next generation of Americans value those things. You know, we're, like I said earlier, a country that is founded on ideas. We're not, you know, Italy, for example, is founded on the fact that they're Italians. Italians, in their kind of shared history and ethnicity and what have you, are a nation because of that. And that's their identity. Italy exists because there are Italian people. Now, America could exist because there's American people, but then you'd be talking about the hundreds of native nations to the land in which we inhabit. And that's kind of the what you would call the American nations. But if they were based on simply the American people, you know, American people come from a vast range of backgrounds and different nations, but we're not, you know, a nation necessarily of those qualities. We're a nation of the ideas that we as a people jointly uphold. You know, there's some of them which we have fairly broad consensus on, but there's some we don't. And it's okay to disagree, but, you know, you can find sometimes when you disagree with someone who is a very different mind, if you can't find a point at which you overlap, it's very hard to kind of come to some sort of compromise. And that's the problem that's happening in terms of our national identity. We, in many ways, can't agree on some of the basics that were agreed on at the outset. You know, we have people that want to expand the scope of government and ensure freedoms from as opposed to freedoms to. What I mean by that is, you know, the idea that, you know, in the absence of government intervention, you have certain freedoms. But there are those who claim that if government acts in your interest, you gain freedom by, you know, having freedom from hunger, freedom from, you know, what have you. But those freedoms from require pulling back on freedoms too. Freedom to spend your money as you please is not very conducive to freedom from homelessness, if that requires government to have a program for housing, because who's going to pay for it? You are. So all things to consider there in terms of, you know, what's going on. I think, you know, and I said this in the aforementioned little article, I think it's important that we look back at the ideas on which we were founded and, you know, kind of look to Argentina and what's going on right now as a reminder of what we claim to hold near and dear to ourselves as a nation, but also as a, you know, at least consolation that even if we fall very far astray of that, there's a way back. There's always a way back. But that way back requires that people are ready and willing to kind of get on the same page, which in some cases has not been the case. But before we get back into that, just wanted to let you know very quickly that Tartan Ink joins you in supporting WRCT. Tartan Ink is a full-service copy print shop conveniently located in the University Cohen Center on Carnegie Mellon University campus. Services provided by the Copy Center include black and white and colored copies, single and double-sided copying, assortment of colored and textured papers, including cover stock, specialty papers such as gloss paper, resume quality paper, as well as large format poster paper. They also offer binding and finishing options that include cutting, lamination, folding, padding, stapling, tape binding, thermal binding, collating, comb binding, and coil binding, as well as being an authorized ship and drop site for UPS shipping. For more information, visit their website at cmu.edu/tartaninc or call 412-268-4828. And if you're interested in underwriting for WRCT, you can email pr@wrct.org for more information. Also, did you know that a single ember that escapes from a wildfire can travel over a mile, carrying a world of trouble? It can land, ignite, and destroy your home and community. You can't control where that ember will land, but you can control what happens before it does. With simple steps to adapt to wildfire, like cleaning areas around buildings, knowing community safe zones, and making sure your local fire departments are prepared, you and your neighbors help protect your homes and community from more wildfire damage. Becoming fire adapted is more than one person can take on alone. It takes a community to protect a home. Visit fireadapted.org today to find more tips and tools to help you protect your home and community from wildfires. Get fire adapted. Public service message brought to you by the U.S. Forest Service and WRCT. Also, just a couple shows we have here on WRCT. Firstly, From Here to Eternity. Everyone thinks they know the 80s hits, but on the other side of the Atlantic lies a treasure trove of synth-drenched sounds that filled the airwaves of Europe back in the day. Take a trip back to the 80s you never knew with DJ Tony Toombs. From Here to Eternity, Mondays at 4 p.m. Also, tune into Kaleidoscope, an eclectic hour of music with your very own DJ Kate, Mondays at 10, only on WRCT Pittsburgh. Add to the colorful mix by calling in requests. Alrighty. Well. So, I say all this to kind of set the tone going into the election as well. You know, we often find that a lot of the discourse that we have today isn't very constitutionally grounded. We're not really kind of taking heed to where the Constitution comes into play. And that's a double-sided issue. I think that both sides of the coin are guilty of that. I think in many cases, the expansion of the power of the presidency that both would seek to undertake would not be conducive to the sort of national identity we've laid out for ourselves. I'd like to think that if any of the people responsible for putting the Constitution together, which is kind of just James Madison, which props to James Madison for putting together the Constitution pretty much by himself. That man practically locked himself in a room for about a year or two, studied pretty much every form of government, came back to the Constitutional Convention and was like, here's the government, have fun. So, if you ever have any qualms with the government, direct it towards James Madison, because very likely he wrote the part that you didn't like. But this all to say, it's concerning how little regard for the Constitution there is in kind of broader discourse surrounding. At least in the presidential context, you know, it's not really touched on much outside of kind of like a passing reference to the values of our nation. And then briefly, you know, afterwards swept aside and, you know, moving on to talking points. You know, you hear the, you know, a big talking point at the Democratic National Convention was this idea of like, you know, just they use the word freedom a lot, but I don't know if any of you have ever watched The Princess Bride, but it's that, you know, there's the one scene where he's like, that word, use it a lot, but I don't think you know what it means. I don't think they know what it means when they use it in the context they do. There's, you know, a lot of lip service to freedom, but not so much action on freedom when you're, you know, willing to engage in other unconstitutional things like, you know, shutting down the country and penalizing people for exercising freedom of movement.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, the New York Times says that Amnesty International recently became the first major international human rights organization to accuse Israel of carrying out genocide in Gaza. That makes sense only if you ignore the other human rights groups and international bodies that have said Israel's actions in the wake of Hamas attacks on October 7th, 2023, meet that definition. The Times account notes that genocide is hard to prove because it involves showing the specific intent to destroy a group, in whole or in part, something that they say Israeli leaders have persistently denied is their intent in Gaza. Declarations like that by Israeli President Isaac Herzog that it is an entire nation out there that is responsible appear nowhere in the piece. The Times tells readers that Amnesty's contention and similar allegations have been, quote, at the heart of difficult debates about the war around the world, close quote. Well, so far, 14 countries have joined or signaled they will join South Africa's genocide case against Israel in the World Court. Gallup polling from April found the majority of the U.S. public, 55%, up from 45% last November, saying they disapprove of Israel's siege of Gaza. That support for Israel is dropping among all political affiliations. A May survey from a private Israeli think tank says nearly a third of Jewish people in the U.S. agree with the charge of genocide, and 34% view college campus protests as anti-war and pro-peace, compared with 28% who see them as primarily anti-Israel. More recently, the Israel Democracy Institute reports its survey from late November, finding that the majority of Jewish people in Israel, 52%, oppose settlement in Gaza versus 42% in support. There is absolutely debate around the world about Israel's actions. Outlets like the New York Times make that debate more difficult by misrepresenting it. While not the first to ask us to see the assault on Palestinians as genocide, Amnesty's report offers an opening for those journalists who are interested to ask why some are so invested in saying that it isn't. Iman Abid is the director of advocacy and organizing at the U.S. Campaign for Palestinian Rights. We talk with her today. But first, a quick look back at some recent press. In September 2023, California passed a law requiring fast food restaurants with more than 60 locations nationwide to pay workers a minimum of $20 per hour, affecting more than 700,000 people working in the state's fast food industry. Listeners will be unsurprised to hear that corporate media told us all that that would devastate the industry. As Connor Smythe reported for Fair.org, before the law went into effect, outlets like USA Today and CBS were telling us that due to efforts to help those darn workers, going to McDonald's or Chipotle is going to cost you more and also force people out of work. This past April, Good Morning America doubled down with a piece about the stark realities and the burdens that restaurants would now face due to the law. Well, now we have actual data about the impact of California's law. The